Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Kay reading the Big Bend Sentinel for Thursday, January 20th, 2022. After death of EMS director, Brewster County looks to fill service gap. By Mary Cantrell, MKCANTRELL at BigBendSentinel.com. Tri-County. The city of Alpine and parts of Brewster County are unexpectedly facing the task of establishing a new emergency medical service provider after Michael Scudder, who operated the area's ambulances since 1985, died at the age of 61 in early December. Brewster County Judge Eleazar Cano recently appointed a task force consisting of Emergency Coordinator Stephanie Elmore, Chief of Terlingua Fire and EMS Greg Hennington, County Commissioners Sarah Allen Colando and Jim Westerman, County Treasurer Julie Morton, as well as representatives from the Big Bend Regional Hospital District and City of Alpine. The Brain Trust has met three times to date and is working on writing up a recommendation for the county regarding the future of their EMS services. The aim is to present their findings and recommendations to the county sometime in March. Terlingua Fire and EMS agreed to lend a hand in the meantime to ensure services are not interrupted for area residents. They agreed to 120 days of assistance, which will end on April 30th. "We were simply being good neighbors," said Hennington. "We would hope that if our EMS went down, somebody would come help us." Scudder's company, West Texas Ambulance Service, served the area for over 35 years. His daughter, the heir to his company, chose not to continue to operate the business. Scudder also ran the volunteer fire department after his twin brother, who served as the station's fire chief, died in 2019. Andrew Pierce now holds the role of Alpine fire chief. The monthly subsidies Scudder was receiving from the county and city to operate EMS are now being allocated to Terlingua EMS to pay for salaries, fuel, and supplies. Terlingua Fire and EMS is operating under their license and got approval from the state to serve a larger area for the time being, said Hennington. The EMS crew currently consists of Terlingua EMS staffers and professionals from other nearby towns. Of the three EMTs and paramedics that worked under Scudder, only one remains. Hennington said of his six available EMTs, he typically has two people on duty. His main concern is burning out existing employees, he said, but luckily they have not seen an increase in COVID-19-related calls, and for the most part, the temporary solution is working out. "I'm not going to say it's going absolutely perfect. There's always a challenge here and there," said Hennington. "We're keeping things pretty much the same because there's no sense in changing it and changing it again." They are currently operating out of the county fire station and renting two of Scudder's ambulances from his daughter. "It's been a community effort," said Hennington. The Alpine Police Department has stepped in to act as ambulance drivers when needed, and Oasis Tire has been assisting with the ambulance's mechanical problems. The task force is considering three major options for the new EMS, said Judge Cano in a Brewster County Commissioners Court meeting January 18th. The county could opt to put out requests for proposals, RFPs, in order to recruit a private contractor. This would likely involve the county, city, and/or hospital district subsidizing the cost to make it more profitable for the business owner. Hennington said Alpine averages around 400 to 500 911 calls a year, which is not a large enough volume to attract a private company without additional assistance. I don't want to do some low-bid deal where 2 years from now they're broke and they're out of business and we can't run anymore, and now we're doing this all over again, said Hennington. Here now is the time to do it right the first time. Another option is for the county to take over EMS, which Judge Cano said is estimated to cost $1.3 million, making that option unideal, if not entirely out of reach. The third option is for the Big Bend Regional Hospital District to take charge of running EMS. The hospital district, the City of Alpine and Brewster County, we would put money into the pot to try to continue to build on basically what the Scudders left behind, said Judge Cano. But that would be a whole different entity that would be led by the hospital district. One of the major advantages to this option, said Hennington, who also serves on the board of the hospital district, is that they are already a taxing entity and could raise property taxes, which partially funnel into the district, to help fund the services. Grant funding through the hospital is another option. The Big Bend Regional Hospital District had not met concerning this matter at press time, but plans to meet in the near future to discuss the option, said Hennington. Regional hospital districts do operate EMS in other parts of the state. Hennington said rural health care, like water, will be one of the major challenges facing our region in the future, and it will be important to raise pay rates for EMTs and paramedics to attract quality candidates. Offering competitive salaries is something the task force can plan for now while they are reorganizing the structure of EMS for the area. We're going to have to be competitive in salaries and benefits, or we'll have a great organization. We just won't have any people, said Hennington. That's the problem everywhere. Everybody's short-handed. South Brewster County became an established emergency services district, ESD, in 2004, meaning their EMS and fire services are partially funded by sales tax collected in the area. Hennington said it provides a couple hundred thousand dollars a year and helps them pay for supplies and salaries. The benefit of the ESD is tourists pay sales tax and in turn are helping pay for EMS services they may utilize. The plans that we're drafting are going to include everything north of the ESD service area, said Judge Cano. If Brewster County decides to operate EMS out of the hospital district, there is a possibility Presidio County will enter into the deal, since they are also covered by the hospital district. Presidio County Judge Cinderella Guevara attended the last task force meeting, said Judge Cano, and is processing information and assessing Presidio County's EMS demands. Marfa EMS Director Bert Lagarde, said an upcoming meeting has been scheduled with him, the mayor, city manager, and the hospital district to discuss the possibility. Marfa's EMS currently operates on funding from the city, county, and grant funds. In addition to funding from the Texas Regional Advisory Council, they also received funding from the Big Bend Regional Hospital District. Lagarde said they recently received $75,000 from the hospital district to spend on a new $250,000 to $300,000 ambulance, and 4 or 5 years ago, the hospital district helped fund the entire cost of an ambulance for Marfa EMS. Marfa EMS covers a wide range, including parts of Jeff Davis County. They have a mutual aid agreement with Fort Davis to cover areas west of Marfa up to the Culberson County line. Jeff Davis County EMS is a volunteer service. "We are covering parts of Jeff Davis County on a day-to-day basis," said Lagarde. The task force will meet again in late January and is currently working on getting numbers together, said Judge Cano. "Everybody's already burned out because of the pandemic. Everyone stepped up, the EMTs and Greg and all the volunteers and the county officials," said Brewster County Commissioner Sarah Colando, who is on the EMS task force. "Everybody has really put this at the forefront of everybody's to-do list about finding a solution." Photo by Mary Cantrell. Nurse Beverly Dutchover conducts a drive-through rapid COVID testing site outside of Marfa Elementary School, where around 25 cars showed up to get tested on January 17th. Marfa ISD closes for a second week in a row as area schools grapple with COVID. By Mary Cantrell, MKCANTRELL at BigBenSentinel.com. By Allegra Hobbs, ALLEGRA at BigBenSentinel.com. For Marfa, for the second week in a row, Marfa ISD has temporarily closed its campus due to a rise in COVID infections as surrounding schools grapple with the virus presence among students and staff during a new, uncertain period of the pandemic. The district announced on Wednesday that all classes will be canceled Thursday, January 20th, through the following Monday, due to a rise in infections. As of press time, 36 people within the school had tested positive for the virus, according to district nurse Beverly Dutchover, who was unable to specify how many of those cases were students and how many were staff members. A total of 98 students were absent from school on Wednesday, said Marfa Junior and High School Principal Allison Scott. That takes into account not only those who have tested positive for the virus, but those who have had close contact with someone who tested positive. "When it gets to be that large of a number, we need to shut down and give everybody time to get well and get out of quarantine," said Scott. Teachers will still come to school Thursday, Friday, and Monday in order to strategize how best to serve students during this time, said Scott. The campus had just reopened after a brief closure due to a COVID outbreak. Classes had been canceled from January 13th to 18th, when 13 students and 4 staff members tested positive for the virus, leaving the schools with insufficient staff to provide instruction. At the start of the year, Marfa ISD had opted to push back the start of class to January 11th, as opposed to earlier in the month, in hopes of giving the virus time to dissipate through the population after the holiday. But even the delay couldn't stop the highly contagious Omicron variant from spreading in the schools. "We were blessed the last year and a half, and it's finally really got us," said Superintendent Oscar Aguero. "We aren't getting out of this one." "The decision to close schools wasn't an easy one," said Aguero, "but with the rate of infections among teachers at the time of the initial closure, they were left with few options. There were not enough instructors to keep classes going. We have protocols, but we were having teachers getting sick. We were having kids out," said Aguero. "It was just getting to a point where instruction wasn't going to be quality instruction." With teachers out due to COVID and a shortage of substitutes in the region, their only option would have been to increase class size, putting more kids together, which would have sacrificed safety, said Aguero. While a shortage of substitute teachers is a reported problem nationally, it's nothing new for Marfa and the surrounding districts, where there aren't enough teacher absences to justify full-time substitute work. Many substitute teachers in the area help service Marfa, Alpine, and Fort Davis ISDs, said Aguero. Upon returning from the break, most of Marfa ISD's staff members and students were wearing masks, said Aguero. He said students have been doing well all year regarding mask compliance, and estimated 70% were regularly wearing protective face coverings. Aguero said he would need to reevaluate with the school board on the topic of issuing a mask mandate. Per an executive order signed by Governor Greg Abbott in May 2021, Texas schools are banned from requiring masks, but a number of districts have since violated the ban. Marfa ISD held free testing on Monday at the elementary school, where around 25 cars showed up to receive free rapid tests from Nurse Beverly Dutchover. School resumed on January 18th, with the district encouraging mask wearing and COVID testing for students who may be presenting symptoms, only to close again 2 days later, with the administration reinforcing testing options. Aguero said they were well stocked with around 150 to 200 tests. Earlier in the pandemic, the district opted into a Texas Education Agency organized effort to routinely send tests to schools for students, staff, and board members. Aguero said in the past the district hasn't had success pivoting to virtual learning, and it is not a feasible option because of the burden it places on teachers. It's hard on teachers, he said. It's already bad enough having to deal with the pandemic that if we canceled school, we were canceling school. Rather than offer remote learning, the school may adjust their calendar to add a few days of instruction. The district planned for 9 bad weather days for the academic year. Aguero said since the start of the pandemic, the school district has worked with the mayor and county judge to implement community-minded actions. Every district's community is different, said Aguero. We were looking at the community as a whole, said Linda Ojeda, MISD athletic director, as well as English teacher for 11th and 12th grades. We don't want the elderly and unvaccinated or whoever to suffer because of the decisions that we're making. Ojeda viewed the closure as a precautionary measure to protect the wider community. The school is one of the largest regular gathering places, she said. We are like the hub. We've got kids coming from everywhere, said Ojeda. A few instructors trickled onto campus over the closure, said Ojeda, to pick up materials and try to prepare for the coming weeks of catching students up. After March 2020, Ojeda said teachers are trying their best to stay ahead and keep instruction on schedule despite the ongoing pandemic. Upon returning from a long break, students are generally off their learning groove, said Ojeda, and it takes time to get their focus back on their studies. That will be another contributing factor to the recent closures, which happened immediately after students returned from winter break. There's also a possibility that the students' state assessment, or STAR, scores could be negatively impacted. Now, we're putting in a pause and then starting again. It does push you back in instruction, but also in really getting them in a routine, said Ojeda. Ultimately, what we look at the end of the year is how they did on their state assessment. So it has set that back. But it's the same thing. Right now, because of what happened in March 2020, they're already set back. Basketball is currently the only sport in season, with both middle and high school teams practicing and competing in games when possible. Basketball teams began practicing in early January before the start of schools at Ojeda. During that time, a few team members missed practice because of a family member's exposure to the virus, she said. The first school closure caused one middle school game to be postponed and one canceled. The high school basketball team competed against Van Horn on January 14th. At press time, no students on either basketball teams had tested positive for COVID, to Ojeda's knowledge. Ojeda said there is a local shortage of officials to referee games, which makes it hard to reschedule, but they are doing so when possible. We're just being cautious. A lot of our student athletes are vaccinated, so we feel good about that. But at the same time, we're canceling, forfeiting, and postponing what we can, said Ojeda. The current phase of the pandemic requires administrators to juggle opposing responses among parents. She says as teachers and coaches, they try to cooperate with families regardless of their viewpoints, but many parents are choosing the more cautious route. Recently, out of a 15-member basketball team, only three players showed up for practice, the rest citing they would prefer to stay home in order to limit their exposure, said Ojeda. You have those parents saying, hey, my daughter's vaccinated. I'm healthy. She's healthy. All these different things. But you have parents saying, hey, that might be a little risky. I'm not going to do it. And that's understandable as well, said Ojeda. You really have to look at both sides of it. I think a lot of the teachers and coaches, even our administrators, have been. So hopefully we're making the best decision for everybody. In Alpine, schools have experienced an uptick in COVID infections but have remained open. As of press time, Alpine ISD was reporting 57 student cases, though its online portal for reporting case numbers resets every 10 days for students and every 5 days for staff. Schools were back in session on the elementary, middle, and high school campuses starting January 4th. In a message to parents sent January 13th, AISD Interim Superintendent Dennis McIntyre reported 233 absences across all three campuses with 53 confirmed positive cases. In the letter, he said closing schools would be a last resort, but would ultimately be a board decision led by available data. Cases have risen, according to the district's COVID dashboard, since the return of school earlier in the month. McIntyre told the Big Bend Sentinel that while the school district has no current plans to cancel classes, the option is not off the table. There are no policies in place at this time, said McIntyre in an email. The district will adhere to TEA guidelines and the laws of the state in making this decision. The surge at AISD is growing. If the district were to see an exponential growth in numbers or staff were affected at a level that prevented the district from safely conducting classes, closure would be an immediate option for the board. McIntyre said, while there is a shortage of substitutes in Alpine, principals have assured him classes have not been combined due to teacher absences. Paraprofessionals and administrative support staff may help cover classes in lieu of teachers or substitutes, he said. The district is providing testing. Administrators are meeting daily to assess the situation, and facilities are being sanitized at least two times a week with commercial-grade sprayers and antivirals, according to the superintendent's letter to parents, January 13th. Fort Davis schools, meanwhile, have no plans to close. Fort Davis ISD Superintendent Graydon Hicks told the Big Bend Sentinel that while the district has seen a few student and staff cases, it was not a significant enough uptick to prompt any scheduling or curriculum changes. Most of our families have been closely monitoring themselves and seeking testing before sending their kids to school, said Hicks. I do not anticipate needing to close for remote instruction and learning.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Fort Stockton Pioneer for Thursday, January 20th, 2022. PCMH proposes pay raise by Megan Waring. Pecos County Memorial Hospital had raises approved for some incoming and current employees at the commissioner's meeting a week ago. The raises could soon include all employees after a decision made by the PCMH board on January 18th at the group's regular meeting. The board is looking at getting all staff's pay bumped up by $3 an hour after an in-depth discussion on the facility's budget and how they can make it work. We know that we were behind on wages, said CEO Betsy Briscoe at the board's meeting. We are having issues getting people to come work for us. A lot of times people would say, no, I can't go work here for $2 to $5 an hour more. The hospital's previous recommendation, which was approved by the board in December, only targeted some positions, registered nurses in med-surg, clinic home health hospice, OR, OB, and ER, licensed vocational nurses, certified nurses aides, phlebotomists, clerks, ER clerks, housekeeping, dietary, and maintenance workers. Upon the county's request, PCMH went back to the drawing board to look at how all staff could be included. We figured it out based on our current budget as it stands right now. We can give everybody a $3 increase. What we're doing is taking it out of the agency costs. So when we did the budget in July, we had budgeted for significant dollars for agencies, and those are outside contractors. Briscoe added that the hospital is working to significantly decrease the need for staffing agencies. Last summer, PCMH needed agency staff members to fill empty positions. The hospital was able to move $515,000 of the budgeted agency staffing funds to employee salaries. Last night's wage adjustment recognizes our existing employees. These last 2 years have been incredibly challenging, and everyone at PCMH met the challenge head-on. December's move was the right thing to do for us as a business. Last night's move was the right thing to do for our employees. The next step for PCMH is to bring the recommendation to the Pecos County Commissioner's Court at a future meeting for final approval. Thank you to our county commissioners, Judge Schuster, and our hospital board members for their support. And a big thank you to all of our PCMH employees. Murder suspect captured. Manuel Adriana Reese was captured by members of the U.S. Marshals Service Lone Star Fugitive Task Force after Mexican authorities charged him with the aggravated murder. Adriana Reese, 25, was wanted by Mexico law enforcement authorities in the state of Chihuahua after he was formally charged with aggravated murder of his wife on August 2021. In November 2021, Mexican law enforcement authorities provided information to the U.S. Marshals Service that indicated Adriana Reese had illegally reentered the U.S. After a diligent investigation by the Alpine and Midland Lone Star Fugitive Task Force and with assistance from U.S. Probation, the Midland County Sheriff's Office, and Midland Fire Department, Adriana Reese was located and apprehended on June 13th, on January 13th in Midland. County burn ban in effect. Due to dry weather conditions, Pecos County is now under a burn ban. On January 10th, Pecos County Commissioners approved an order prohibiting outdoor burning in the county for a 90-day period beginning January 10th, ending April 10th. The order does not prohibit outdoor burning activities related to public health and safety authorized by the Texas Natural Resources Commission, including firefighter training, public utility, natural gas pipeline, or mining operations, planting or harvesting of agricultural crops or burns that are conducted by a prescribed burn manager. The commissioner's court of a county can put a burn ban in place when drought conditions exist in all or part of the county, according to the Texas Forest Service. The northern half of Pecos County is drier than the southern half just because the southern half had a little more rain. But it's still dry enough for a burn ban. The Keach Byram Drought Index, which ranges from 0 to 800, 800 being the driest conditions, was at a mean of 530 for Pecos County on January 19th. The maximum reading in the area was 738 and the lowest was 346. A violation of the order prohibiting outdoor burning is a Class C misdemeanor, punishable by a fine not to exceed $500, according to the local government code. City Parks Department Goes Above and Beyond by Jeremy Gonzalez. The City of Fort Stockton's Parks and Cemetery Department does more than just mow grass and fix sprinklers. City Manager Frank Rodriguez has stepped forward to commend the crew for all of the additional hard work they do behind the scenes, which sometimes goes unseen by the public. These guys have done an awesome job keeping up our parks. They are assigned so many other projects that the community may not be aware of. Beyond taking care of public city sites, the department also tends to City Hall. In particular, every morning they spray high-grade sanitizer on office doorknobs, desks, break rooms, city vehicles, and equipment to prevent the spread of COVID-19. They've got a great team that works really well together. They do a lot for a crew of only six people, and when they do fall a little behind, they always manage to find a way to meet their deadline. It's impressive, and I'm truly grateful for them. They're our go-to crew. If you need something done, call the Parks Department. The Parks team works behind the scenes during holidays and local events to set up special event stage, put up banners and flags, clean up after their events, and tend to the Rio Street walkway, all while keeping the city cemetery clean and the park's grass manicured. With playground safety, Spray Park maintenance and extensive landscaping on their annual to-do list, Park and Cemetery Supervisor Nathan Day credited his team by sharing one straightforward sentiment. Simply put, I couldn't do it without them. City Native helps provide BBT service. When you choose Big Bend Telephone, you're choosing to keep it local. For Stockton, Native Jose Romero exemplifies that in the city he grew up in and his family. The 2015 Fort Stockton High School graduate is one of the company's two sales leads in the area. Romero has been based in Fort Stockton since starting to work for the company 3 months ago. BBT is one of the best companies I've ever worked for. It's straight to the point, he said. That's the biggest thing I stress to our companies. When you're calling somebody, you're calling someone local. You're not calling somebody across the country or world. When you call BBT, you'll get one of three representatives in Alpine, according to Romero, and they will easily connect a customer to their local sales lead for prices and scheduling. Romero emphasized it's a seamless process and service could be provided anywhere from the same day to 5 days out. The Fort Stockton native added that the first fiber internet that BBT provides in Fort Stockton runs down Dickinson and Main Street. BBT also provides service to residents. What stands out the most about BBT is that we have fiber running through Fort Stockton, all the way down Dickinson and Main Street. We're focusing mainly on businesses. That's what we're focusing on, get more people to BBT so that we can expand that fiber into residents. Romero plans to progress in his career with BBT in the future and help provide the best internet and phone service in Fort Stockton. Call BBT at 800-592-4781.
I'm reading from the Monahans News for Thursday, January 13th. Franco retires after four decades behind the badge. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. Hard work has been a habit for Elias Franco all of his life. For much of that time, Franco has patrolled the streets of Monahans, guarded school crossings, and responded to calls for help. He retired this week from the Monahans Police Department after 40 years behind the badge, serving the community and the people he loves. Franco joined MPD in 1982 after stints at the Reeves County Sheriff's Office and Colorado City Police Department. A career as a police officer was something Franco said he wanted since he was a child. Quote, "I made up my mind at 9 years old that this is what I wanted to do. My mom didn't want me to be a cop, but she always supported me," Franco said. Originally from Barstow, Franco was born and raised in Ward County. Quote, "I was born in a barn at Sullivan Farms. They didn't believe in hospitals back then," Franco said. The second of four children, Franco said, quote, "I remember the whole family waking up at 4 a.m. every morning, and in the summer, I would go work with my dad in the fields." By the time he reached high school, Franco's parents were earning enough money that he was able to relax some and did not have to work every day. Quote, "I would still go to Pecos Friday through Sunday to work odd jobs, but I participated in sports at school too," he said. While working one of his many odd jobs, Franco met Raul Flores, who would eventually give him a shot at a career in law enforcement. The two quickly became close friends. Quote, "During our lunch breaks, we would talk about our future plans, and I would talk about wanting to be a police officer. Raul would always say, quote, I want to be the sheriff, and when I'm sheriff, I'll give you a job," he said. The two lost touch after leaving the job, and Franco said, quote, "I forgot all about it," end quote. After graduating from Barstow High School, Franco discovered he still had the yearning to become a police officer and took criminal justice courses through Odessa College Extension in Pecos after working at the Automotive Proving Grounds outside of Pecos. Lacking 12 hours to graduate, Franco again needed to leave school to return to work full-time. During his time at Odessa College, Franco recalls meeting a lot of really good police officers who encouraged and helped him, including former Monahans police chief and city manager David Mills. Quote, "Mr. Mills was one of my instructors and would always tell me, when you finish school, come see me and I'll give you a job," he said. Franco met the love of his life, Lana Neal, while working at the test track. The two married in 1978 and shared three sons. Franco was soon promoted to a technician with Armstrong Rubber Company, which was housed within the test track. Quote, "One day I was doing a report, and Raul called me out of the blue and said, 'Hey, mijo, I'm the sheriff. Do you want to come work for me?'" he said. Franco finally had a chance to live out his childhood dream when he began working for the Reeves County Sheriff's Office. Quote, "I worked as a dispatcher, a jailer, and in the ID department. When I was off duty, I would go out with other deputies. That's really how I began training," he said. One of his close friends, Jesse Dominguez, who had also worked for the Pecos Police Department and the RCSO, asked him, "Franco, if I was a big shot, would you come work for me?" Shortly after, Dominguez applied to the Colorado City Police Department and got the job. Quote, "When he left, he said, 'Remember, you said you would come work for me when I become a big shot,'" Franco said. Sometime later, Dominguez was promoted to sergeant with the CCPD, and he called Franco to offer him a job. Quote, "I resigned, and I made the move to Colorado City by myself. I couldn't afford to move my wife and two sons with me then. I was sworn in and given a badge. No training, just street experience, but Dominguez had a lot of trust in me and knew what I could do," Franco said. Once Franco saved up enough money, he rented a house and moved his family to Colorado City to live with him. After 4 months, the department sent Franco to West Central Texas Council of Governments Police Academy in Abilene, where he received his peace officer license. In late 1981, Franco, and with the persuasion of his wife, he decided it was time to return home. On a weekend off, he made the trip home to talk to David Mills about a job. At the time, Mills was chief of police in Monahans. Quote, "My wife began packing as soon as I left. She knew I would get the job," he laughed. Franco was indeed hired and began working for MPD on January 13, 1982. Over the decades, Franco experienced monumental changes in his field, especially technological advances. Quote, "My office is basically in my patrol unit. Every time they would put a new piece of equipment in my unit, I would ask, 'What do you want me to do with that?'" he laughed. Franco's career is filled with significant moments, but he says none more so than the events of January 7, 1987. The incident involved a barricaded suspect on 2nd Street. Franco was shot in the face with a shotgun from a distance of about 10 yards. Injuries as a result of the gunshot included a pellet in his retina, facial injuries, and an injured knee when he fell back after being shot. Quote, "I've had about 10 surgeries and was off from work for about a year," he said. After 35 years, Franco took the role as Special Assignments Officer on September 29, 2016, just 2 days before his 68th birthday on October 1st. Quote, "Chief Billy Riley called me into his office one morning, and I thought I was in trouble," Franco said. Quote, "Sit down, Franco. I'm going to give you an early birthday present," Riley said. Riley's birthday gift involved the new position. As Special Assignments Officer, Franco was responsible for enforcing city ordinances, school zones, truck violations, summons, arrest warrants, and serving as municipal court bailiff. Franco never planned on retiring. So why would a man who has worked his entire life and never planned on retiring retire? Franco said, quote, "I just knew it was time. This may sound crazy, but I woke up one morning, and as I was shaving and looking at my reflection in the mirror, something told me it was time to retire. I couldn't get to City Hall fast enough," end quote. Franco has left a legacy for the officers who follow him. Franco's son, Michael, serves as Ward County Sheriff Chief Deputy, and his grandson, Brock, was sworn in as a deputy early January. Asked if he had any advice for upcoming officers, Franco said, quote, "My advice to current and upcoming officers would be to always have a good appearance and unit, be respectful, self-discipline, and take any training the department has to offer. Respect the citizens, create good reports, never lie, analyze the situation before making a decision, and remember, the community comes first," end quote. Franco is currently looking to purchase a ranch where he can raise cattle. In the meantime, he is learning to be a citizen again and enjoying his retirement with his sons and grandchildren fishing, hunting, golfing, camping, and cooking outdoors. Quote, "I still catch myself waking up at 4 a.m. and starting to get up. I tell myself, 'You don't need to get up,'" he laughed. Old habits are hard to break. New jail site approved. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. Meeting in regular session on Monday morning, Ward County Commissioners selected a site for the new Ward County Jail. The commissioners had the choice of one of three parcels of land currently owned by Monahans Economic Development Corporation along Seeley Avenue. Site 1 is a parcel behind the old Sunset Motel. The second choice was behind and between Site 1 and the Archway Club, while the third choice was a bit further west and behind the Archway Club. Each location was estimated at 12 acres. The site chosen was the second location, as the dimensions are more conducive to the needs for the jail and will provide better access from Seeley Avenue, Business 20, and the East Monahan Subdivision along Interstate 20. In addition to the new sheriff's office and jail, the location will provide space for a firing range, vehicle impound area, and an animal shelter. The next step will be for MEDC to deed the property to the county, and then activities could begin to clear the land and hire an architect specializing in jail construction this summer. Commissioners approved this site choice, but Precinct 4 Commissioner Eddie Nelms abstained, as he also serves on the board of directors of MEDC. In addition to Nelms, Commissioners Tino Sanchez, Larry Hanna, and Dexter Nichols were present for the meeting. County Judge Greg Holly was also present. In other business, two bids were received for 54,000 square feet of paving of various roads around the county and a 50,000 square feet at the Million Barrel Museum. The first bid was from Permian Paving in the amount of $2 per square foot for the 54,500 various road needs and $2.25 per square feet for paving of the Million Barrel Museum. Cost for the various county roads would be $108,000 and $113,000 for the museum. The second bid was from Rubio's Paving in the amount of $1.65 per square foot for the 54,500 various road needs and $2 per square feet for paving of the Million Barrel Museum. Cost of the various county roads would be $89,700 and $100,000 for the museum. The commissioners acknowledged that the county has had favorable experience with both companies, but the lower bid from Rubio's Paving was accepted. The Ward County Event Center was approved as the permanent polling place for Precincts 1E, 2, 3N, and 4E. The former location was the Ward County Library, but the Event Center was used as the polling place during the renovation of the library. The change is effective immediately. Judge Holly said, quote, "The Event Center will work better as there is plenty of space and more parking for voters than the library. The library worked fine for the last constitutional amendment election as voter turnout was low, but we are expecting heavier turnout for the primary election with several locally contested races, and the space and parking at the library is just not large enough," end quote. The next meeting of the commissioners will be held on January 24th at 9:30 a.m. at the Ward County Courthouse, 400 South Allen Street. Abandoned well spewing brine since January 2nd. The story was written by Smokey Briggs. According to reports obtained via an open records request to the Railroad Commission of Texas, an abandoned well in Crane County, 12 miles east of the Ward County line, began spewing produced brine water 200 feet into the air around January 2nd. The original rate of flow from the well was gauged at 20 barrels or 840 gallons per minute on January 3rd, and it was still spewing brine with no reported change in rate on January 11th. The well is about 12 miles east on State Highway 329, traveling from the intersection of State Highway 18 and State Highway 329 in Grand Falls. Railroad Commission District Director Jeffrey Morgan reported that a landowner originally reported the leak, and Railroad Commission field inspectors were dispatched to the site on January 3rd. At the time, the ownership of the well was unknown, and the well was not marked on either the RRC public website nor the Texas Water Development Board website, Morgan said. On that same day, CUD Well Control was contacted, and the Railroad Commission dispatched two senior inspectors to the site to meet with CUD representatives on January 4th. In that same initial report, Morgan said there was no fire or explosion danger and no hydrogen sulfide present. Railroad Commission reports state that the well was first drilled in October 1948 to a depth of 1,390 feet with a cable tool drilling rig. Afterwards, the casing was pulled and the well was plugged, but in June 1957, the well was re-entered to test for gas. In a Gulf Oil Corporation document filed with the Railroad Commission dated October 20, 1957, Gulf representatives stated it had re-entered West North Waddell et al. Core Hole Test Number CT-112 in Crane County. At some point thereafter, the well became one of thousands of abandoned wells in Texas, and when the geyser was first reported, the Railroad Commission could not locate any operators whose operations were associated with the well. However, on January 11th, Morgan reported that the well had been identified as Gulf Oil Corporation West North Waddell et al. Test Well Number 112, and successor corporation Chevron had been contacted and would be taking over operations to deal with the well as of January 12th. Dealing with the well means finding a way to cap off the old well bore, no small task, according to Morgan's email reports. Because of the nature of the well, CUD and the Railroad Commission decided to cut the well casing and place a wellhead over the well bore, Morgan said on January 4th. But first, the produced brine had to be controlled and the ground firmed up enough for heavy equipment. As well, Morgan reported that there were two injection wells, each about 1.2 miles away from the leak, and the Railroad Commission was shutting in those wells, presumably in case those injection wells were pressuring more water into the underground aquifer that was feeding the flow of the Waddell hole. It should be noted that the Railroad Commission has not speculated as to the cause of the flow. Over the course of the following week, Morgan reports CUD mobilizing more and more equipment for the effort, with disposal of the water being the primary concern as pits were built to better contain the flow and to allow for the area around the well to be evacuated so that the wellhead could be set. On January 7th, Morgan reported, quote, "Having completed construction of a secondary pit, approximately 80% of the flow will be diverted to this pit. Everything is bermed up and contained. There are 25 vacuum trucks running to keep up with fluids. We are still building the sump pump next to the well. A trench will be dug from the well to the pit to divert fluids. We'll start digging out around the well afterwards. We'll cut back the casings to find a suitable point to place the wellhead. The blowout preventer cutters and all equipment needed are on location," end quote. After mobilizing enough vacuum trucks to deal with the flow, Morgan's next headache was finding enough injection well capacity to get rid of the stuff, a problem he reports on January 8th, quote, "Due to the volume of water removal, disposals in the local area can no longer accept fluids," he said. At this point in the operation, Morgan reported that 125 truckloads of water were hauled in an approximately 24-hour period spanning the day and night of January 7th and 8th. On that same day, 55 loads of gravel were also hauled to the site and spread on roads and across the pad being built. Morgan also reported that CUD has requested a no-fly zone to be established over the well, as an unidentified drone had been spotted flying over the site, and it was considered a safety concern. In his January 10th report, Morgan relates that while they had found more water disposal locations, finding enough vacuum trucks had become a problem because, quote, "Some of our current drivers, companies, are no longer sending trucks due to being overworked." CUD stated they are starting to reach out to water hauling companies from Oklahoma, East Texas, and Louisiana, End quote. In the last email report produced by the Railroad Commission, dated January 10th, Morgan said, quote, Cudd continued to dig around the wellbore. Water was continually being pumped away from the wellbore to facilitate evacuation efforts. Cudd will continue to dig around the wellbore tomorrow, with plans to cut casing back from the well to place the wellhead. End quote. Editor's note. The Railroad Commission responded to our open records request that was filed on January 10th later that same afternoon. We will update this report in next week's edition. COVID-19 numbers on the rise. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. The recent surge of the Omicron variant of COVID-19 is hitting Ward County as well. As of Tuesday night, there were 187 active cases in the county. On Monday, Ward Memorial Hospital CEO Leticia Rodriguez said that about 85% of the new cases are of the Omicron variant, quote, but the Delta variant is still with us as well. Because of the volumes, getting test results back is now taking a couple of days, end quote. According to Texas Department of State Health Services, there has been 1,540 confirmed cases in the county since the pandemic started last year. There has also been 708 probable, 37 deaths, and 2,024 recoveries. County Judge Greg Holly said on Monday, quote, numbers in Ward County continue to sharply increase, as they do in places around us and across the state. The Omicron variant is certainly spreading rapidly. By now, it seems most of us know people who are sick or have recently been sick. Generally speaking, we're seeing a more contagion variant this time, but with less severe cases for the most part. Immunities from immunizations and from previous infections seem to be helping in that regard, end quote. Statewide, there are currently 627,000 active cases. In total, there has been 4.2 million confirmed cases, 882,000 probable, 75,000 deaths, and 4.4 million recoveries. Williams takes plea given 50 years. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. A Monahans man who was charged with aggravated sexual assault, a first-degree felony, in February 2020 after he allegedly impregnated his 17-year-old daughter, has been sentenced to 50 years in prison. David Wayne Williams, age 40, of Monahans, waived his right to a jury trial and pleaded guilty to the felony offense on Tuesday, January 11th. Ward County 143rd Judicial District Court Judge Mike Swanson then handed down the 50-year sentence according to the plea agreement. At the time of Williams' arrest, the victim in the case made an outcry regarding the abuse to family members who in turn contacted the police. Child Protective Services and Harmony Home conducted interviews with the victim, who disclosed that the father of her infant is her own biological father and that he has been sexually abusing her since she was 13 years old. Williams has remained in the Ward County Jail since his February 2020 arrest, 699 days.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.